Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today, well, it's a bit different. We're not tracking hackers this time or, you know, a market crash.
No, today we're really getting into the weeds of professional IT.
Exactly. We've got this analyst report and it details a server crisis, a really severe slowdown. And at first glance, it looked, exactly like some kind of sophisticated attack.
But it wasn't. It turned out to be something much closer to home, more insidious, really.
So we're dissecting what sounds like a masterclass in troubleshooting under pressure.
That's right. The core issue was this critical server, right? Supporting multiple services for clients.
Yeah.
And it suddenly just tanks. Drops to maybe 10% of its normal speed.
10%.
Yeah. And for any business, there's basically a denial of service. Functionally, anyway.
So our goal here is to follow the analyst's journey, right? Oh. Through the triage, the containment efforts.
And eventually figuring out the pretty astonishing root cause.
10% speed. I mean, that's just chaos, isn't it? And the immediate thought has to be, okay, attack.
Absolutely. Are we being hit? Is this external?
But the analyst's first reaction, and you highlighted this from the source material, it's critical. Don't panic.
Yes.
Why is that specific mindset so important when things go sideways that badly?
Well, because panic leads to mistakes. Simple as that.
Yeah.
If you immediately jump to conclusions, assume it's malice,
right,
and start, reconfiguring firewalls or pulling plugs, you could easily break things even further.
Make it worse.
Exactly. So the priority in those first, frantic moments, it has to be data integrity.
So not just checking CPU load.
No. I mean, they did that too, but the first real action was confirming backups. Were they still running, even slowly?
Okay.
And then, crucially, initiating a backup of the backups.
Ah, belts and braces.
Precisely. That way, no matter what happens next, you know recovery is possible. It buys you breathing room, mental space, to actually start the detective work.
Okay, so let's unpack this chaos. The report says the analyst is, stuck in meetings.
Yeah, trying to manage this in 5-minute bursts between other things.
Yeah. Crazy. So first step, containment, load shedding. They've got this shared setup, maybe 20 domains per server.
Something like that, yeah.
And the plan is to shift the easiest ones off the struggling server first, try to lighten the load.
Right. Standard procedure, really.
Right.
Adjusting which servers handle which services. But here's where they hit the first big snag.
Oh.
A massive self-inflicted wound, you could say.
Yeah.
A ghost from a previous project.
Okay.
The domain name server, DNS, specifically its time to live setting, TTL.
Ah, yes. I remember reading about this, the TTL issue. It sounded like an absolute nightmare.
It really was.
So what exactly is TTL, just quickly, and why did it mess up their plan?
Okay, so TTL is basically, it's like an expiry date for DNS information on the internet.
Right.
If you set it low, say 5 minutes, which the analysts apparently used to do,
yeah,
then other servers check back every 5 minutes for updates.
Okay, so that's pretty responsive.
Very. If you need to switch a service's IP address to a healthy server quickly, 5 minutes is, well, it's manageable. You can react fast.
But the report says they had this forced vendor switch recently. Google to Squarespace, I think.
That's the one. And the new provider, as part of that switch, seems to have just reset all their TTL values.
To what?
4 hours.
4 hours.
4 hours. Yeah. Just think about that operationally.
Mm.
For you listening, imagine. You need to move a critical service right now.
Yeah.
But you change the DNS record, and for the next 240 minutes, a chunk of the internet might still be sending users to the failing server.
Oh, wow. So much for rapid response.
Completely gone. It just removes that tool from your toolkit.
I can just picture the headache. That one little configuration change, probably buried in the migration process, means you can't just flip a switch.
Yeah.
You have to run the service on the failing server and the healthy replacement for 4 hours, hoping they don't tread on each other's toes while the main system is still choking.
Exactly. It severely hampered their ability to contain the damage quickly.
So what did they do? They couldn't just wait 4 hours.
No, they pushed ahead anyway. They changed the main DNS entries, the A records, and immediately set the TTL down to whatever the new provider's minimum was.
Trying to shorten the pain for future changes, at least.
Right. And they also had to scramble to generate new SSL certificates for the replacement servers.
Why?
Ah, vendor incompatibilities, it seems. Just another hurdle.
But the report mentioned a clever workaround for the users, right? To bypass that 4-hour wait somehow.
Yes. This was pretty smart engineering under pressure, I thought.
What did they do?
They temporarily went in and actually altered the JavaScript include files and the domains they were shifting.
Ah, client side.
Exactly. They basically hard-coded the address of the healthy server directly into the code the user's browser downloads.
So the browser will go straight to the right place, ignoring the old DNS info.
Pretty much, yeah. It forced users' connections to the working servers immediately. It didn't fix everything. Complex server stuff is still slow.
Yeah.
But it shielded most users from the worst of the four-hour DNS lag. And crucially, it bought them time. Time to find the real problem.
Okay, so containment is sort of in place, but the core issue, that 10% speed, is still there. Time for diagnosis.
Yep. And the first big diagnostic step was about elimination. Ruling things out.
How?
They had a cold standby server. You know, duplicate machine kept offline.
Specifically so it wouldn't get hit by whatever was happening live.
Precisely. Protected from live attacks, 0 days, configuration errors.
Oh.
So they brought this cold standby online.
Okay.
Updated its content to match the live server, and then ran tests. Importantly, through the exact same network infrastructure. Yeah. Same switches, same ISP connection.
Different result.
Normal speed. Ran perfectly.
That's the smoking gun, isn't it?
It is.
It proves it wasn't the network, not the internet connection, not the DNS weirdness. It was the primary server itself, something on that machine.
The hunt narrows. So the analyst checks the usual suspects next. Internal application logs. Nothing. Everything looked fine from the application's perspective.
Which must be incredibly frustrating.
Oh, yeah. That's often the point where you just want to, you know, grab coffee and stare blankly at the screen. The problem's hiding.
So where did they look next?
Back to basics. The fundamental detective tool for sysadmins, The system logs, usually in Varlog on Linux systems.
Why system logs if the application logs were clean? What's the difference?
Well, application logs only tell you what the program thinks is going on or what it's programmed to report.
Right.
System logs track what the underlying operating system is doing. Network connections, authentication attempts, hardware issues, kernel messages. Much lower level stuff.
Got it. So how did they approach that? Just wade through megabytes of logs?
Not quite. They used a simple command first, LSL. It just lists files, showing their size, and crucially, the last time they were modified.
Looking for activity.
Exactly. Yeah. Looking for any log file that was growing rapidly or had been updated very, very recently. That points you to where the action is.
And they found something.
They found two log files that were getting updated constantly, about once per second.
Okay. Now we're getting somewhere. What was in them? How did they see?
They used another standard tool, tail-f, that lets you watch a file as it's being written to in real time.
And the big reveal was not a massive brute force attack.
No, that's the twist. It was just repeated, perfectly legitimate remote authentications.
Legitimate.
Yep. Over an encrypted channel, too. The report specifically says the remote systems were logging in, setting up the secure connection, and then basically not doing anything.
Just logging in and sitting there.
Or logging in, doing maybe a tiny check and logging out. Over and over. Non-malicious, but absolutely relentless. Once per second.
Wait, hold on. Let's break this down. How does a legitimate process, just logging in, cause a catastrophic slowdown? We're talking 8 to 10 times slower.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? It comes down to the sheer sustained resource drain, even from legitimate activity.
How so?
Every single time one of those remote systems established a new secure session, the server CPU had to do a bunch of work.
Like what?
Cryptography, mainly. Key exchange calculations, checking the remote system's credentials, setting up the unique session keys for the encrypted tunnel.
Okay, that sounds intensive.
It is, computationally. Doing it once is fine, but when it's happening hundreds of times a minute, continuously, starts to push the server's overall load average, a measure of how busy the system is, past a critical point.
And when that load average spikes, you mentioned a great phrase in the notes, memory thrashing.
Exactly. Memory thrashing.
Mm-hmm.
Think of your computer's RAM, the fast memory, like your actual desk space where you work.
Okay.
When the system gets overwhelmed, it runs out of that fast desk space. So it has to start shuffling things it needs right now off to the slow storage, the hard drive.
Using the hard drive like extra RAM, virtual memory, or swap space.
Precisely. But accessing the hard drive is incredibly slow compared to RAM, orders of magnitude slower.
So the system spends all its time shuffling data back and forth instead of actually processing.
That's memory thrashing in a nutshell. The system is tripping over itself, constantly waiting for the slow disk. And that's what caused the massive slowdown, that factor of 8 to 10.
Wow. So it wasn't an attack. It was death by 1,000 legitimate paper cuts.
A denial of service achieved purely through sheer, repetitive, legitimate activity, just overwhelming the system's ability to handle that cryptographic setup constantly.
And to make diagnosing it even harder, the source material says the origin of this traffic was hidden.
Yeah, hidden behind multiple NAT gateways, network address translation, even double NATs in some cases.
Okay, for listeners, NAT is what lets lots of devices on an internal network share a few public IP addresses, right?
Correct, which is great for saving IP addresses, but it makes tracing a connection back to the specific machine that started it a real pain.
Like finding a needle in a haystack behind another haystack?
Something like that, yeah. They had to painstakingly trace the connections back, peeling away the NAT layers.
Until they found the culprit, which was...
The surveillance system.
The surveillance system.
Yep. And an internal R&D asset, apparently used for network visibility and recovery monitoring.
The irony.
It's pretty potent, isn't it? The very system designed to watch the network and ensure things were okay.
Was the thing causing the massive outage.
Exactly. The watcher was unintentionally the attacker.
And the root cause, the ultimate trigger, was software updates, which the analyst seems to really dislike.
Yes. The report mentions a sort of systemic policy, or at least a strong tendency, to avoid updates whenever possible.
Why? That sounds counterintuitive.
Their reasoning, based on experience apparently, is that updates too often break backward compatibility. They fix one thing but cause two new problems.
Especially security updates.
The analyst seems particularly frustrated with those, yeah.
Yeah.
The view expressed is that they often break working systems without actually closing off realistic attack vectors, especially if other protections are already in place.
So connecting the dots, the pursuit of security through constant updates can actually introduce huge operational fragility.
That's the argument being made here, yes. And this incident is presented as a prime example.
So how did updates specifically cause this problem? It sounds like a chain reaction.
It was a perfect storm, real daisy chain of issues.
Yeah.
Okay, so the surveillance system itself had recently received an update.
Right.
This update was meant to improve how it restarted its monitoring processes if a remote system it was watching seemed to fail or go offline.
Okay, sounds sensible.
But that restart mechanism originally had a bug. A bug the analysts had actually found and fixed previously.
Ah, so the fix was in place on the surveillance system.
Yes. But then a completely separate software update was applied to the remote server being monitored.
The target server, okay.
And that update caused some process on the remote server to fail.
Yeah.
Maybe it crashed or didn't respond correctly.
So the surveillance system, with its newly updated and fixed watchdog,
sees the remote system failing because of the other update. And its perfectly working fixed restart logic kicks in.
Trying to reestablish contact.
Repeatedly. Vigorously. It started initiating multiple rapid news sessions trying to connect to the failed remote system.
Each one causing that CPU-intensive cryptographic setup.
And collectively overwhelming the primary server where those authentication requests were landing. It wasn't the original bug. It wasn't even just the new update on a remote server. It was the combination of the analyst's own previous bug fix reacting perfectly, but excessively, to a failure caused by a different vendor update elsewhere.
Wow. That is complex. A cascade failure triggered by trying to make things better.
Precisely.
So after all that detective work, digging through logs, tracing NATs, the immediate fix sounds almost anticlimactic.
Off in the way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
They basically just had to revert the problematic update on the remote server.
Roll it back.
Roll it back to a known good version.
Yeah.
And then reboot the surveillance server itself to kill off all those frantic queued up connection attempts.
Stop the flood.
Stop the flood. And the server performance presumably returned to normal pretty quickly after that.
Okay, so that's the fire put out. But the report talks about the after action, what they call managed maturity.
Right. Learning from it. Trying not to make the same kind of mistake again. This goes beyond just fixing the immediate bug.
And that means permanent changes to their infrastructure and processes.
Looks like it. First off, updating their internal playbooks, their standard operating procedures for system setups, to specifically catch and fix these broken vendor updates before they get deployed widely.
Being more careful with updates, basically.
And also, finally addressing that 4-hour DNS TTL value that caused so much pain during the initial containment. Fixing that permanently.
Closing that door. What else?
They're also looking at adding more redundancy. Things like redundant NAT gateways, automating shifts between different internet service providers if one fails.
Yeah.
Just building more resilience.
And there was one other proposed change that sounded quite advanced. Digital diode sniffers.
Mm. Yes, that's interesting.
Sounds like something from a spy movie. What is that and why? What does it do that normal firewall logs don't?
Okay, so a digital diode, or a data diode, is fundamentally a one-way network connection. Data can flow out, but absolutely nothing can flow back in.
Physically impossible.
Physically impossible. So a diode sniffer uses that principle. It sits somewhere on the network and passively sniffs or monitors traffic passing by.
Okay.
It sends its findings out over that one-way link to a monitoring station. Because it's one way, the sniffer itself can't be compromised or controlled from the network it's watching.
Ah, I see. So it's an independent verification.
Exactly. It's a way to check completely independently that your firewall rules, your routing policies, are actually doing what you think they're doing. You're not relying on the potentially compromised or misconfigured system's own logs. It's about non-mutable independent verification.
Very clever. Okay, what about the backups? That cold standby server, there is an issue there too.
Yeah, the report mentions that the current automated restore process to the cold standby takes too long.
Why?
Seems to be due to data fragmentation over time. The data isn't stored efficiently for a fast restore.
So what's the plan?
The proposal is to shift away from a truly cold standby that's almost never touched. Instead, move to a more frequent but minimal testing routine.
Like?
Maybe bring it online briefly, say monthly or quarterly. Run a quick differential restore test, just updating the changes to keep it synchronized and defragmented. Check it works, and then immediately shut it back down.
So it's cool rather than cold.
Something like that. It's a balance.
Right.
You trade a tiny bit of that absolute cold security for much faster recovery time if you actually need it. But you minimize the risk by only having it online for very short, controlled periods.
Makes sense. And finally, the report touches on this, the surveillance paradox.
Yeah, the analyst kind of acknowledges that, you know, 99.9% of the time, nothing happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you get tired of constantly, intensely watching for things that just don't occur. Surveillance fatigue sets in.
But as this whole incident shows, when something does happen,
it might not be the big external attack you're watching for. It might be your own legitimate processes reacting in unexpected ways, often triggered by updates or configuration changes.
And the only way to catch that early is often through those same logs and monitoring systems.
Exactly. The logs are the ultimate audit trail, the ground truth.
Yeah.
But they only help if the system is logging the right information and if someone is still paying attention when the alerts go off. Especially, as in this case, when the alert is just a high volume of seemingly normal, legitimate activity.
So this whole deep dive, it's a really powerful lesson, isn't it? Audit trails, logs, they're absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the biggest threat to your system's availability isn't some hacker group. It's a chain reaction, a cascade failure, kicked off by perfectly legitimate internal processes reacting badly to maybe well-intentioned but poorly tested software updates.
The watchers watching the watchers. Until the system inadvertently ties itself in knots.
Yeah.
And the report, it mentions this goal of managed maturity, trying to build systems and processes so you don't make the same mistakes over and over.
Right.
Which brings up, I think, a really crucial question for you, the listener, to ponder. When you're dealing with these incredibly complex interconnected systems, how do you actually measure and manage mistakes? Especially when the very act of trying to improve a system, deploying that security update, fixing that known bug, like the analyst did, is so often the trigger, the root cause of the next unexpected critical problem.
Yeah.
How do you innovate? How do you adapt and improve without constantly inadvertently introducing new, subtle, hidden points of failure into your operational environment? How do you manage that inherent fragility?